You're listening to another episode of the Young Investors Podcast, so sit back and relax as myself, Brandon, and my buddy Hamish discuss the latest in the world of finance and stock market investing. Now, a quick reminder before we get into the podcast is that nothing in this podcast should be taken on as personal financial advice. If you're ever unsure about your finances or investing and you need some help, make sure you reach out to a qualified financial advisor. But with all that said, let's get into another episode of the Young Investors Podcast. Hey guys, welcome back. How you doing, Hamish?
I'm doing well. As well as you can be. Another week of lockdown.
How you doing?
Yeah, going along, cruising along. Very sick of being in lockdown at this point, but I think we've probably got a while to go now, and hopefully people can just get vaccinated. We can get to the 70-80% I think we're aiming for, and then we can go from there. And then I'll
and
be,
you're all booked in.
Yeah, I'm all booked in. Yeah, so everyone, go book in if you can.
Yeah,
please.
Well, I think most people should be able to at least try and book in.
Yes.
Because we're in the 20 to whatever it is, or 16 to 29 category.
Yeah.
I was able to register and it said, yes, you're eligible. And then it said, we will let you know when you can book in. Then I just haven't got the email. But yeah, hopefully, I mean, to be honest, I'm keen to, you know, let's get these jabs. Let's get vaccinated. The sooner we do it, the sooner we can get back to what we'd call normal. But I tell you what, being in lockdown, this is relating to a question that we got on last week's podcast. Someone asked, Hamish, how is your puppy going? I imagine you're going to be, you've been spending a lot more time with, I forget what the puppy's name is, Rosie or something?
Lucy. Yeah.
Lucy.
Yeah, funny. Right. As soon as you said that, I can just hear her start barking somewhere in the house. No, she's doing well.
We need a code
well.
Name. Maybe we use Rosie as a code name to stop the dog from barking.
No, I think she's appreciating the lockdown because we're spending so much time with her. So.
Yeah.
No, she's going well. I still call her a puppy, but she's, I mean, almost 3 years old. She just decided not to grow. So she kind of looks like a puppy permanently, but yeah, she's going well. Good. Thank you for that question. And that reminds me, if you do have any questions for next week's podcast, make sure you go over and leave them on the YouTube version of the podcast. If you're not aware, you can ask us questions and we try and get to as many as possible by the end of the podcast.
I think we've actually almost sifted through all of the questions that we had in backlog. Mm. So, yeah, I think we've only got like two or three that we can choose from for today. So, yeah, definitely. If you've got any sort of question or discussion topic, then feel free to head on over and ask a question. But still looking to be a pretty jam-packed podcast today. I don't think we'll be pushed for time. We've got Tesla AI Day. That was, wow, man, that blew my mind. So I'll talk a bit about that. We've got some interesting news about Netflix as well as the airline industry, and also a follow-up on this whole, what was it called, news media bargaining code.
Yeah.
It's all related to that, isn't it? And what Google and Facebook is paying them and whatnot. Or is that a different story?
No, that's, so of course we've got some earnings coming out from Australian companies now, and as a result, we're starting to see some of these new news publishers report earnings. And within there, we can start to see these deals that they struck that have been kind of confidential up until now. We can kind of see what is the result of that for these publishing companies.
Interesting. And I'm also going to talk a little bit about the space industry as well. Mm. So, there's some interesting news. A lot of SPACs going down in the space industry at the moment. Ooh. But we'll get to all of that and some of your questions right after this. Mm. Do you like that? Take it away, Hamish.
Beautiful. Today's episode is sponsored by ShareSite, which is an application you can use to track the performance of your stock portfolio. So, it'll basically allow you to bring in all of your trades either automatically through connecting your associated broker or manually if you want to, and it will basically track all of the gains that you receive. So, capital gains, dividends, if you have dividend reinvestment plans, it will do all of those calculations for you. Currency gains, if you're buying shares internationally or you hold foreign currencies. And then the main reason why I've been using ShareSite over the past few years is for when it comes to tax time. So, ShareSite generates up to, I think, 12 now different reports that can be used to track the performance of your portfolio, as well as used at tax time to work out things such as your capital gains, dividend income, and more. At the moment, you can try ShareSite for free by heading over to ShareSite.com/young investors. That's site spelled S-I-G-H-T, ShareSite.com/young investors. So use that link, sign up to a free plan and track up to 10 holdings, 10 stocks for as long as you want. Or you can also use that link to get 4 months off a premium plan, 4 months off a yearly subscription of a premium plan. As always, thanks to everyone who has used that link when signing up to ShareSite and is supporting the podcast. Thank you.
And the podcast's channel.
Yes, true. I could have saved that.
Yeah. It's good to always have ShareSite on board. I just popped into my head, why don't we just pre-record a sponsor bit for ShareSite? We should just pre-record and then just splice it in. You wouldn't have to spend all that time going through ShareSite each week.
I mean, you make a good point. Why did we take until the 143rd episode to think of that?
We could have just had like a pre-recorded half minute, 45-second clip, and then we could just that's the level of professionalism here at the Young Investors Podcast. Oh, dear, where should we start? What should we talk about? What you interested in, Hamish Hodder?
We have to start with this Tesla AI Day stuff because I know absolutely nothing about this. I don't really keep up to date immediately with when Tesla does these kind of events, but I'm always so interested to hear what crazy stuff they've got going on. And I've seen some memes and some things floating around. So, I think I have a little bit of an idea of some of the things that came out of this. So, take it away.
I mean, I've got to be upfront. I don't know. I was watching this presentation and thank goodness they had some quite visual slides, which made it kind of easier to understand. But man, because they brought out, you know, Andrei Karpathy and Elon Musk did a talk, and then they've got these other people that head different divisions of AI and autopilot and stuff. Oh my gosh. It was so technical, which is completely what it was designed to be. It was completely designed to be talking to people that are in the field of AI.
Yeah.
So for us plebs at home, it's probably a good thing that we didn't understand most of it. But man, I'll try and get through what I understood. And I had to do a little bit of research, watch a few YouTube videos to get to this point because, it was very technical. And I do not have that kind of technical knowledge on self-driving and artificial intelligence.
But I mean, the truth is, I think that's actually what you really want from a company when they do these kind of investor day, basically, where they talk about certain segments of their business. Because you see other companies and their investor day presentations are just, it's just so transparently a sales pitch. Like they don't go into any detail about, what the growth drivers are of the business and what their strategy is going forward and what are the internal metrics they're tracking, you know, and they just kind of do a big fluffy thing about, well, this market is going up, and they just have a picture of an up arrow.
Yeah, exactly.
And so I much prefer when they go way deep into the details of what they're doing. And Tesla is certainly one that does that in every single one of their presentations.
Yeah. It gives you more confidence as an investor that they actually know what they're talking about. And they have a complete laid out, plan to actually do what they want to do, as opposed to, yes, this is just a marketing. we're talking to you today because we're trying to sell our stock. So I was very happy to see that it was in depth, even if I didn't really understand it. So what happened? Well, so they discussed the improvements in their self-driving system. What was interesting is they did a lot of comparisons as to where the system was, say, 3 years ago to where it is today. Mm-hmm. And oh my gosh, when you look at where it was 3 years ago, because they do these little vector space, what the car was interpreting versus what it's interpreting now. 3 years ago, it was so inferior to where it is now. It was honestly quite amazing to watch the car read the road in vector space, because you're looking at the cameras and then you're looking at what the car is drawing in vector space. And it's like, how can the car even see? Like it's painting, you know, three lanes in all directions on an intersection. It's like, man, I can't even see the three lanes over there, but it knows it. It knows that they're there. It was quite remarkable. I definitely encourage you to at least have a look at some of those animations of what the car is drawing in vector space as it goes along. Very, very impressive. But then what happened after Andre Carpathy showed, did his little talk on the vision side of things is that there was another presenter who I forget the name of, who announced the new chip design for their full self-driving learning machine, which is called Dojo. And again, I'm not a computer guy, but man, this seemed very impressive and everybody in the room seemed extremely impressive. So, if you are a computer guy or girl, I will tell you the specs of this new chip computing AI self-learning machine and hopefully it impresses you. So, at a fundamental level, they announced the D1 chip, which has 354 nodes, and each node can process over 1 teraflop per second. So, that forms the basis of the D1 chip. That you can tell that I'm just reading, can't you? I don't really.
Whoa, 354 nodes.
Oh my gosh. But then the D1 chip is then surrounded by an input-output ring that has more than 2 times the bandwidth of what's the gold standard state-of-the-art networking chips. Then 25 of these chips go into a training tile, which gives over 9,000 teraflops, so 9 petaflops. And then this becomes what they call the training tile. So, this 25 of these D1 chips together is the training tile. And then that becomes the base unit for scale of the Dojo training system. Then they put 6 of these tiles into a tray, 2 trays in a cabinet. And then Tesla wants to do 10 cabinets, which, and they were very excited about this, creates an exapod, 1,080 petaflops or 1.1 exaflops with, as they say, uniform bandwidth and low latency. And that was the big breakthrough, is that they were able to maintain their bandwidth. So, essentially, what, you know, I can't say that I really understand what was going on there. Hopefully, you guys do. But what I took out of it is that the Tesla Dojo team have just seen that what's out there at the moment is not good enough. They've just gone out and demolished what was there before, and they've just created a machine that will be able to handle all of the data and essentially just learn really quickly. And overall, I thought that was pretty cool. And they certainly seemed very fired up about it.
Yeah, I mean, I'll be honest, I probably understood about 4 words out of that entire paragraph that you read, but it sounds impressive.
Well, in that case, let's then move on to something that maybe is a little bit more understandable, although maybe not in some elements. The big news of the day was, of course, Elon unveiled the Tesla bot. Did you see this? I'm sure you would have seen this.
I saw this.
Yeah. So, this Tesla bot is going to be a humanoid robot that Tesla is going to start working on next year.
Oh, God.
At this point of the presentation, I was literally just like jaw on the floor kind of. Like, this was, I was, because I'm current, I don't know if anyone's a big video game fan out there, but I'm currently playing through Fallout 4. And in Fallout 4, there's this faction which creates, you know, synths, essentially humanoid robots. And I was like, wow, I'm seeing what these synths are doing in the video game. This is hitting a little bit too close to home right now.
Yeah, it's funny that, because I'm actually also, I'm going through Westworld at the moment. I'm watching Westworld. Oh, so
you would have got the same vibe.
Yeah, it's I don't know why you would want to make a robot that looks like a human. like I don't know. I mean, I guess it probably will have some advantages. Maybe you're going to talk about that. I'm not sure, but I don't know. It's just a bit creepy, especially if you've watched Westworld. It's just like, oh,
yeah.
I don't know. I don't trust them.
How good is Westworld, though?
Oh, it's great. I've watched it probably about 4 times all the way through. Probably my 4th or 5th run at the moment. So,
really?
Yeah, I love Westworld. Probably one of my all-time favorite shows. So,
yeah, it's great. I actually think you got me onto Westworld.
I think I did.
I think you suggested it to me.
Yeah.
There was a
period where I'd watched it for the first time and I was just going around telling everyone to go and watch this show. Because it's so good.
Honestly, I think Westworld season 1 is probably the best season of any TV show I've ever seen, ever.
Yeah. It's just so well put together. And I really enjoy shows where they get you with a twist. Some shows will try and do a twist and they won't really get you, or it won't be that surprising. Westworld, just no matter if you tell somebody that there are so many twists and they're looking out for them, you will not catch the twists that come in that show. So, it's really well put together, really well written.
Absolutely not. Yeah. I love it. I need to go watch it again. I need to go watch it again because I've only seen the second. It was the three seasons, right? Third season, I've only seen once. I think I've seen the first season twice because I just liked it so much. Anyway, back on topic, hey?
Back onto the real world where.
Well, I guess. back in the real world where. You know, Tesla is making Westworld come true. essentially they announced this Tesla bot. It's going to be 5'8". It's going to weigh 56 kilos. And it's going to utilize the full self-driving computer and an array of vision sensors and other sensors to be able to navigate the world and perform tasks, which is pretty interesting. But, you know, Elon was specific that, you know, He wanted to make sure that the Tesla bot could outrun it and you could also overpower it. So hopefully you shouldn't ever have to fear the Tesla bot like you might fear some of the Westworld characters.
I mean, it's a weird thing to say.
It is a weird thing to
worry,
say.
Don't worry, you can overpower it. Like, what do you mean? No, tell me that it's under control.
Yeah, exactly. He's pretty much saying, look, we think it's going to be great, but you never know. I was like, oh my gosh, Elon, don't say that. But anyway, the idea is that this Tesla bot is going to be able to take over repetitive, dangerous, and boring jobs that are currently done by humans. And essentially, they want to make it... The idea behind this bot is that they don't want to have to program it to do a specific task. Elon was very specific. They want this bot to not need specific training. They want it to be able to go through, navigate the world. And, you know, if you tell it to do something, it can, you know, it uses its learning algorithms and it goes and does it.
Yeah.
Wowee. Elon, he also has some interesting things to say. He's really stopped referring to Tesla as a car company now.
Right.
He said long-term, you should think of Tesla as an AI and software company. Of course, people will always say that it's a car company. Why? Because it makes cars. But he really sees the cars as robots on wheels, and it's really the software is their fundamental core technology, and their software and AI can then be applied to different applications. It's just at the moment, its application is full self-driving, a robot with four wheels. So,
yeah. I mean,
very interesting.
It's the software and the AI, and that is what makes Tesla different from every other company, but different from car companies. So, makes sense to look at them in that way.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I thought that was really interesting. I thought this was really interesting. But who would have thought Tesla is building a humanoid robot?
God.
Wowie. And that was AI day. It just seems so surreal.
They always have something crazy that's going on. They always have to top it every single year, I feel. I feel like they always do something ridiculous.
Yeah. They just need to focus on getting these cars built at the moment, to be perfectly honest. But then again, Elon was very upfront, and I think the whole reason they announced this bot was because they said that this was a recruiting demonstration. Like, the whole reason for AI Day, its number one reason was for recruiting purposes. They want people to come and get pumped up about what they're working on and come and join Tesla. So it kind of makes sense why they're talking about this, but he was questioned as, hey, does this even work with Tesla's mission? Tesla's mission is to advance the advent of sustainable energy. And he was like, well, to be honest, it probably doesn't, but it does. We probably need to update our mission statement. So people have kind of criticized him like that, I think it was just mainly recruiting. So they want to announce something that gets people fired up in case there's, you know, a robotics expert out there that's pumped up to work on humanoid robots but doesn't actually want to work on full self-driving cars.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, I mean,
so yeah,
that,
interesting.
That's the advantage of companies that get to that size and have that kind of brand, that nature of brand associated with them. Like something like a Google, where you know there was a massive period of time where that's, you know, and even still, I'm sure, where you want to go and work at Google because it was just such a enriching experience to be an employee there. I guess Tesla can kind of give the same thing, and that's a huge advantage over other companies for getting really good people to work for you. Not just having to attract them on pay, but attracting them because people specifically want to work there and build on what Tesla is. So yeah, really interesting.
Yeah, absolutely.
I want to talk about this a little Netflix scandal that
what's been going on.
Yeah, so I just saw an article related to this, and I hadn't heard. This is something that's been going on for a few years now, it's kind of reached somewhat of a conclusion, so I guess that's why people are talking about it now. But there was actually an insider trading scandal going on at Netflix. Insider trading is, of course, where insiders within the company are trading illegally on private information that's not yet public, and making money doing that. So there was a scandal of that sort going on at Netflix over the past few years. So last week we found out that there was actually three former software engineers and two associates. So not necessarily people who were, you know, massively high up in the company, but software engineers and two associates that were charged with insider trading. So yeah, you don't see these in the news too often. I'm sure they happen all the time at a small scale, but particularly when it comes to a big company that has massive stock price movements, as I'm sure many people are aware. If you look at Netflix's stock price, it moves a lot on earnings days, for example, or on news announcements, when there is public private information that is turning into public information, and the stock goes up 5-10%, or it goes down 5-10%.
True.
So, at the center of the scheme was a person called Sung Mo, and allegedly, this person made over $3 million between 2016 and 2019. And what he was doing was, he actually wasn't, I'm not actually sure, the article wasn't clear as to whether he was doing insider trading himself. But he worked at Netflix, and he was actually sharing information with other people, and they were paying him for that information. So he's kind of like the centerpiece of the scheme, and then there were other people around him who were trading on the information and then sharing some of the profit with him. At a pretty basic level, he was allegedly sharing information about subscriber growth before earnings announcements. So pretty simple but effective scheme. Course, subscriber growth is probably the number one thing people are looking at for Netflix. It's a pretty basic business when it comes to earnings releases and people trading on them. People want to just look at the subscriber growth. If it's going to beat expectations by a lot, the stock will likely go up, although not always. But you know, it can be a fairly, almost a fairly certain trade if subscriber growth or subscriber numbers are going to be massively better than expectations. So to have that information before the earnings announcement is, of course, not legal. But allegedly, he was sharing information with his brother and a friend before various earnings releases, and he was being paid $60,000 each time sharing information to each person. He actually left the company in 2017. However, he then continued to receive information from another insider, Aiden Lee. So the company and then had someone who was still working there continue to relay information to him so that he could then on-sell that information. In total, the complaint made by the SEC alleges that they made illegal trades before 13 consecutive earnings releases over 3 to 4 years. So, this is a long time that they were doing something like this. And it's really, it's a really simple thing to be doing. I'm sure that I'm not exactly sure how they would have got access to the numbers before the announcement, but I mean, I'm sure a lot of people within Netflix had access to that, or that it was spoken about, you know, within the company. So, yeah.
You'd have to be fairly high up though, wouldn't you?
You would imagine that, I mean, specifically to prevent things like insider trading, you would imagine that they have to keep these kind of numbers, you know, quite protected at the top of the company. Mm. But yeah, it's pretty interesting.
So he's getting $60,000 for each one of these leaks, and he gets, what, 4 opportunities to leak this information per year. So he's getting potentially like $240,000 a year from leaking this information.
Yeah. And I think that was $60,000 from each person was paying him. So he was sharing information with a number of people and yeah, allegedly made over $3 million over the 3-year period. So yeah, it's a significant amount of money to make on the stock. But
yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah.
I listened to a podcast, or I think I half listened to it because I think I fell asleep. I was listening to it at night about there was an insider trading scandal in Australia not too long ago with the ABS. And I can't remember what it was. It was something to do with foreign exchange. And it just, listening to that podcast, it just made me realize that, like, honestly, insider trading could be quite common. Like, I feel like a lot of people in the world would have access to, you know, insider information, and could potentially act on it. I don't know how big of a, you know, task force is set to kind of look into insider trading, because I mean, to be honest, I've actually had one situation already in my life where I have had insider trading. Sorry, I've had inside information.
Did you just confess?
I chose not to act on that insider information because I met a CEO of a publicly traded company. But yeah, even that, I was like, man, I've bumped into insider information. So it must be very, very, you know, common. I wonder how much. There's probably a lot of insider trading that happens that just goes completely unknown. Like, people just don't know about it. It's kind of scary.
Yeah. And
I'm sure it's very, I'd be pretty confident that it is fairly common.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's a couple of things. I think there's obviously the degree at which a person uses inside information to make money, right? If you're making millions of dollars, that's going to be on the radar of the regulatory bodies, because if you're just an employee of a company and all of a sudden you luckily made this massive successful trade on your own company stock, that's going to, you know, be quite a red flag. But then there's also the degree of how, like, transparent the information is, because there would be certain things that might not move the stock, or they may or may not move the stock, and there'll be some information that will move the stock. So something like the announcement of an acquisition is, or the announcement of a bid is probably the most transparent you can get, where if another company is making a bid for a company, or maybe they agree to buy the company, that's going to move the stock significantly. And it's almost a certainty. So, you get this, like, wide, like, array of people doing insider trading, and the people who are making those money and trading on really highly guarded information, like the subscriber rate in Netflix case, they are the ones that usually get caught, because they go too heavily into it. But yeah, I would not be surprised at all to know that a lot of people engaged in it, because yeah, it's probably quite difficult to regulate, I would imagine.
Difficult to regulate. And I also feel like it's hard to keep information to yourself. And I feel like if you're smart about it, you know, as long as you don't draw attention to yourself, if you had insider information, you probably could figure out a way where you could place some trades and make some money without it being, like, too obvious.
Yeah.
We're going to start our own insider trading ring now.
It's a really fascinating thing, because something I learned actually last year, because around Pfizer, was there was an article that was going around that the Pfizer CEO had bought a bunch of stock or sold a bunch of stock just before they released the results for one of their COVID vaccines, and the stock went down significantly the day after or something like that.
Right.
And the article was suggesting, well, is this insider trading? But what it actually ended up happening was big CEOs like the CEO of Pfizer and a lot of American companies, I'm sure around the world as well, to avoid the perception that they may be insider trading or trading on inside information, they actually use another company to manage all of their trades, and they schedule their trades many months in advance. So whatever trades they want to do, a lot of the time it's already scheduled in. And this was the case for the Pfizer CEO, even though it looked like he sold a bunch of stock and then the next day an announcement was made and the stock went down, that trade was already recorded and scheduled months prior.
That makes sense.
So that he can be like, even though this looks like I've done insider trading, here's the record of me signing off on this trade months before. So I clearly was not doing insider trading. Because then there's the other side of it, which is that if you are an insider that has a lot of inside information and you are trading the stock, you may look like you're committing insider trading when in fact you're not, just because a coincidence of an announcement or the stock price moving on a certain day. So it is it's a whole interesting thing. But I just thought that was an interesting story that I saw come up, because we don't see those too often with big companies like Netflix.
Yeah. No, that is very interesting. It's very interesting. Sparked a good conversation too. Insider trading.
We got a confession out of Brandon as well.
Confession.
We'll be dealing with that after this podcast. Don't worry, everybody.
Yeah, I can already hear the sirens.
The knock at the door.
Here they come. Yeah. all right. What should... I got to talk about what's going on in the space industry at the moment. It's pretty crazy. SPAC City. So we've got two stories to talk about. We'll start with Rocket Lab. Have you heard of Rocket Lab before?
No, I haven't actually.
No, they're like a small launch to orbit company out of New Zealand, actually.
Oh.
So Rocket Lab began trading on the NASDAQ on Wednesday, becoming the latest space company to close a SPAC merger and go public, substantially adding to its cash pile in the process. Quote, "We're super excited to bring a high-quality space asset to the market." You would say that, Rocket Lab CEO Peter Beck. So, the company merged with special purpose acquisition company Vector Acquisition, which valued Rocket Lab at $4.8 billion in equity. The deal and the $777 million in gross proceeds from it will help the company grow its core small rocket business, further expanding its spacecraft unit, and build a larger rocket called Neutron to take on Elon Musk's SpaceX. Honestly, I don't know. The media likes to play these space companies against each other, but I don't think Rocket Lab is particularly looking to compete with SpaceX. I think they're still the CEOs describe them, you know, SpaceX is the freight train or the big hauler, the cargo ship that leaves once a month, whereas Rocket Lab aims to be like the FedEx that's constantly doing small deliveries here, there, and everywhere kind of thing.
Right.
So
okay. Interesting.
But yeah, there you go. So so we've got Rocket Lab going public through a SPAC. I'm just trying to skim through this article here. Shares of Rocket Lab declined 9.9% in trading on Wednesday to close at $10.43. Asked about the stock's debut slide, Beck said that he hadn't even been watching it. He emphasized that at the end of the day, we're in this for the long term. I mean, to be honest, I don't know whether that's obviously the truth or not, but it is nice to hear someone not obsessing about their company's stock price.
Yeah, or at least pretending not to obsess.
Yeah, exactly. But here's the interesting thing. So, I said Rocket Lab's launch business booked revenues of $13.5 million in 2018, $48 million in 2019, an estimated $33 million in 2020. Mm. And despite the hit last year, Rocket Lab expects launch revenue growth to rebound this year and steadily climb to $915 million by 2027.
My goodness.
So, wow. So yeah, it's...
They got a pretty big projection there for... For their growth, what a 10, as
yes.
a, well, not a 10x, a what is that? More than a 10x over the next 7 or so years, 30x or something like that.
Quite substantial. Wow. Quite substantial. I wanted to bring that specific sentence up out of this report because of what we'll talk about next.
Okay.
I don't know. Do you have anything more to add on Rocket Lab?
No, not particularly, except for the fact that they're doing $30 million in revenue and they valued the company at $5 billion, which is absolute insanity. But moving on.
And that's the thing. It's the space industry as well. So, it's not like it's a cheap business. It's not like it's a high-margin business.
No, exactly right.
Yeah, but so that's our first little story, Rocket Lab going public through a SPAC. Next, Virgin Orbit is going public through a SPAC.
Goodness. Maybe we should just, for those who don't know what a SPAC is, it's a special purpose acquisition company. And it's basically like where it's basically a fund that's set up. People invest in the SPAC and they don't know what company they're going to be investing in. And then the person who's running the SPAC will then try and make an acquisition. They'll basically try and merge the money they raised through the SPAC with a private company and then take that private company public. So that's kind of how that goes. Did I explain that all right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Yep. No, I wouldn't add anything more to it. That was exactly what happens. And then, so we've got Virgin Orbit. So, this is the satellite launching spin-off company from Virgin Galactic. It essentially uses a Boeing 747 to fly up very high with a rocket strapped to it. And then the rocket just falls off the bottom and then just launches to space. Similar kind of system to what Virgin Galactic does with their rocket. But yeah, the actual payload rocket launches off the bottom of like a modified commercial airline. Mm. Boeing 747. So anyway, Virgin Orbit is preparing to go public, announcing Monday that it will merge with a SPAC to list on the NASDAQ. So the company is combining with special purpose acquisition company Next Gen Acquisition Corp. 2, as CNBC reported in June. Branson said, I certainly wouldn't have invested $1 billion if I wasn't extremely confident. We've had great experience with SPACs, and I'm hoping that we'll have the same experience with Virgin Orbit. So, the SPAC values Virgin Orbit at $3.7 billion in equity. The deal is expected to raise $483 million for Virgin Orbit, including a $100 million pipe round or private investment in public equity raised by investors such as Boeing and private equity firm AE Industrial Partners. Okay, this is, remember what we were saying before about the profitability expectations of Rocket Lab.
Oh, no. It
says here, Virgin Orbit aims to be profitable on an EBITDA basis by 2024. Okay. The company says it has about $300 million in active contracts with another $2.3 billion in identified sales opportunities, quotes, identified sales opportunities currently being pursued. Yeah. CEO Dan Hart told CNBC that the company's core rocket business will, quote, be growing at about 18 launches in 2023. So, the company expects to have about $15 million in revenue this year with an EBITDA loss of $156 million. But Virgin Orbit aims to grow that revenue quickly. Get this. Virgin Orbit aims to grow the revenue quickly in the coming years. Who would have thought? Forecasting $2.1 billion in revenue by 2026. What do you make of that?
It just makes me sad.
It makes you sad. Oh.
Give me $156 million and I'll turn it into $15 million for you. You don't need to need to go through a SPAC and a space company. I'll do that for you.
It is pretty funny, isn't it?
Yeah, that's the most ridiculous sentence I've ever heard. Identified sales opportunities. That's just the dumbest thing I've ever heard. If any other company said something like that, like could you just imagine if any other company said something like that? That, oh, we've only got $300 million in contracts right now, but there's $2.3 billion that we're actively pursuing, that we're trying to get this... Like, yeah, that's your business. When you get it, put it on the income statement.
And the biggest jump in that is that the company expects to have $15 million in revenue this year, and then they forecast $2.1 billion in revenue by 2026. It's like, geez, that's a fair jump, isn't it? Isn't it? $15 million to $2.1 billion.
Yeah, that sounds stupid. That literally sounds like what the internet companies were projecting back in 2000. These companies expecting 100% growth per year for the next 10 years. This is ridiculous. Yeah.
And honestly, I wanted to talk about these two news stories, firstly, because they're quite similar and it's kind of funny that they're obviously going public at this current time in the market, which we've spoken about previously. But I also wanted to put this in because it's something that I would have, in like 5 years ago, I would have read before I knew about Buffett-style investing and, you know, couldn't even tell you what free cash flow meant or owner's earnings or anything like that. It's something that I would have read and I would have gone, oh, wow, they're doing $15 million in revenue right now, but in 2026, they're going to do $2.1 billion in revenue. That seems like a great investment opportunity. Like, that would have would have been me like 5 or 6 years ago. And honestly, reading through this article, it highlighted a really poor investment that I made a few years back called, which was in Sky and Space Global, because there was a lot of similarities to what I read in this article to what I was reading about Sky and Space Global, which was, again, it was a space company. They were trying to launch, to essentially make a smaller version of Starlink that SpaceX offers. Right. And the things that I learned from that experience of losing money in that investment is that anything to do with space is really capital intensive. Mm. And definitely for that reason, be cautious, 100% believing that the growth plan will work out 100% as the CEO tells it. That's the real trap that I fell into, is that the CEO was essentially just a salesman and was saying, look, you can make 10 times your money. We're going to do this much revenue in this year. Oh, don't worry that we haven't even put a single satellite into orbit yet. Don't worry about that. We're going to make, you know, billions of dollars in 10 years. And I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
But yeah, definitely be very, very cautious of lofty revenue projections when, like in this case, Virgin Orbit, they've done $15 million in revenue this year, and then they're projecting $2.1 billion.
Yeah,
to me that just, because I've now had that past experience, that immediately flashed a red light at me.
Yeah, you've got to be particularly careful of businesses that are right around either just about to go public or they've just become public. And the reason why is because there's one reason why companies go public, and it's to raise capital, right? They don't go public for fun. If companies can stay private, a lot of the time they do, because it's a hassle to be a public company. So if a company is going public, especially one that's not profitable, they're doing it to raise capital. And what does that mean? It means that for the period just before they go public, and even just after, where they will probably still do a number of other capital raisings, sell more additional shares, the management team, particularly the CEO, is going to be talking about the best possible outcome for that company, because they want to paint it in the best light and get as much money as possible. And you have to be really careful of that. And that's very different to a business that has been listed for 20 or 30 years. They went through their need for capital 20 or 30 years ago, and now they're self-sustained, and maybe it's still run by the founder. So he's just talking honestly about what is happening in the business and what's realistic for the business. That's a really different situation to a business that has to hype up the stock to get money or else they go out of business. So you just have to be really careful with these kinds of businesses. And honestly, the easiest way to avoid uncertainty with these kind of companies is to just avoid investing in them. That's what I do with the vast majority of these things. Anything that's a new company that's not profitable, that requires huge expectations in the future, just has a lot of uncertainty. And if you avoid them, then you don't have to, you don't have to bet on the horse. You don't have to bet on the horse race. You can just not bet on that race and put your money somewhere else.
Yeah. No, I agree. 100%. 100%. But anyway, that is my cautionary tale of me getting some red lights flashing while reading these stories.
Yeah.
Learn from my past mistakes. Anyway, should we move on? What should we talk about next?
Yeah, I had a couple of kind of short earnings things to talk about out of Australian companies, because as I mentioned, we're starting to see that. So I thought maybe we'll go briefly through these and we won't spend too much time on them. But out of the airline industry, of course, is a big story at the moment, still struggling in Australia because of our lockdowns. So I thought we could take a look quickly at Qantas, which is, of course, the biggest airline in Australia, and their financial results for the 2021 financial year. And it's still not very good. Let's just say that revenue came in at $8.7 billion, which was down 58% from their 2019 levels. So from 2 years ago, pre-pandemic, academic levels. I mean, that's really just the result of what the CEO said, that it's the result of two things, really. One is that they had a full year of closed international borders and 330 days of domestic travel restrictions.
Wow.
It's even surprising that they were still able to do, you know, 42% of their 2019 level with that being the situation. No international travel, which Qantas does a lot of, and very limited domestic travel. And on a profitability basis, or a lack thereof, I should say, it was not pretty. Yeah. They took a loss for the year of $1.7 billion. That comes after a $1.9 billion loss last year, and down, of course, significantly from their profit in 2019, which was $840 million. So, in their current state, the business is not profitable, and that's not really surprising to anybody. Again, not as bad as space travel, I'm sure, but air travel is very, very capital intensive. Whenever they have really small margins, and when they lose a lot of revenue, they go into the red very, very quickly. Interestingly, they started to announce some more timelines about reopening international flights, although they had done timelines 6 months ago and a year ago, and those timelines were absolutely shattered. So, take this with a pinch of salt, but they said they're likely going to be able to open flights to what they quote as COVID-safe regions, so the US, the UK, New Zealand, and a couple of other places where they have-
COVID-safe.
I mean, yes, you say that with a pinch of salt, but it's places that have high vaccination rates- and low rates of and low COVID cases, although I'm not sure you could classify the US or the UK in that, but that's how they described it. So, don't come after me. Come after Qantas. But they also said that other countries with low vaccination rates and high COVID cases would come much later. So, these are places like Bali, Phuket, Ho Chi Minh City, really popular destinations for Australians to travel. Those places won't come until April of next year. And they also don't expect to be back to full capacity, 100% capacity, until mid next year, which is kind of crazy, because I remember when this thing sort of started, and I'm invested in a travel business, a corporate travel business, so it's a little bit different. But I remember thinking, well, how long do I, you know, let's kind of make a little mental prediction of how long this goes for, and how long revenues will be impacted. And there's no way that I would have predicted that, you know, there would be 2.5, maybe 3 full years of revenue and profit impacts for these businesses. I probably expected that maybe it would be 12 to 18 months. So, I think these businesses have been probably impacted for a lot longer than a lot of people expected. And I think that just reinforces the idea that you want to invest in businesses that stay profitable during these kind of rare events and have low debt, so that if this event went on for 4 or 5 years, you know, these businesses would still survive, and that you don't have to worry about bankruptcy. But not really surprising. And
I think that's why Monish Prabhai said in one of his talks recently that he believes the airline industry is uninvestable.
Right. Yeah.
Like he thinks it is just too, honestly, too hard, because there are just so many question marks that are completely outside the control of the airlines. It's like what you were saying before, how, you know, they had the international flights plan, and then that obviously got completely destroyed because now we're riddled with COVID again. And so it's just like, and then they might make another one. We'll reopen international flights by December to the US. And then it's just like, oh, Australia gets smashed with even more COVID, or something else happens. And then that goes out the window. So, yeah, it's very difficult. As you say, you know, it's a capital intensive business. I mean, profits in the good times are like, and then profits in the bad times, like, whoa.
it's one of those businesses where if they were to survive, because pretty much every airline goes bankrupt at some point. I think four of the major airlines in the US have gone bankrupt at least once. I think American Airlines has gone bankrupt multiple times. So, for an airline to not do that, they have to really keep like a massive reserve of cash just in the event of a recession. Like it just sits there. They don't touch it. And that's very hard for a business to do. It means that they're return on invested capital, their efficiency will be go down massively because they just have this huge chunk of, air quote, inefficient money that's just sitting there as a protective layer. And then you get a situation where, you know, it had been 7-8 years since a recession, you know, leading into COVID, and all of the four major airlines in the US said, well, okay, we're going to start doing share buybacks, and do a bunch of share buybacks with the cash that they were using as a reserve. And then, of course, then came the time when they needed that money. So it's a tough business to invest in, for sure. I think very capital intensive, very cyclical. So
yeah, and to try and make, if you wanted to invest in these businesses right now, to make any sort of prediction or model out into the future, I mean, how confident are you going to be? I mean, we look at a company, I don't know, like a Google or a Facebook, which is just seeing consistent growth. I mean, how confident would you be making a prediction? If I said, Hamish, can you do a discounted cash flow model for Qantas, and can you make an estimate of where they might be in 10 years? Like, how confident would you be in doing that?
Yeah, not at all. Extremely difficult to invest in these companies. And I mean, Qantas still isn't cheap on a valuation basis. I mean, if they had no debt, if they weren't losing money, then maybe you could, and the stock was extremely cheap to the point where, you know, maybe even if their profits went down, they would still make you money or something like that. Then you could get to a point where you're like, okay, this makes perfect sense. But that's not the situation with any airline that I know of. So difficult business to forecast, maybe even impossible.
Rough. Yeah. Yep. All right, should we fly through this Nine Entertainment, Google, Facebook news?
Yeah, this is probably even quicker than the last one, but Nine Entertainment, which is, of course, a publishing and media business in Australia that was one of the companies that struck a deal with Google and Facebook. So, they reported their earnings, but that deal, for those who are unaware, basically the Australian government was threatening to introduce some legislation that would force Google and Facebook to pay news publishers to share articles in Google searches and in the news app. And we spoke about this over a number of episodes because of how ridiculous that is, that Google is literally providing free traffic to these publishers. And then the government decided that it made sense that they should also have to pay to provide free traffic to the publishers, and that they couldn't just remove them from the search, that would also be illegal. So, you're compelled to provide the service for free and pay for it. So, it was ridiculous. But in the end, a lot of these, this is a bit of a biased news story, as you could tell. In the end, Facebook and Google struck deals with these companies, so they didn't have to submit to the bargaining code, but they basically are now paying directly these companies. So Nine Entertainment reported their earnings expectedly. Their publishing businesses and print subscription businesses saw revenue declines as they have for many years now. Digital subscriptions rose 20% to $102 million in revenue, and that includes things like paid articles on news publishers such as The Age, and their streaming subscriptions from their video streaming platform, Stan. They actually said that in that year, they didn't include anything from the Google and Facebook deals, but they did reveal how much it would increase their revenues in the next year. So, we got to find out what that deal was. And they said that it would add about $30 to $40 million in revenue in the next year. So, basically, their current digital subscription revenue is about $102 million. So, Google and Facebook are going to be subsidizing Nine's profits by about 30 to 40%. And the reason why I say profit is the overall company's profit for the period was about $117 million. And they're going to be getting an additional $30 to $40 million from Google and Facebook. So,
oh my gosh,
a big part of their business now is literally Google and Facebook paying them to put articles in the news app. So there you go.
Well, you can see why they wanted to make this deal.
Yeah.
You can see why they pushed it so hard. I mean, that is actually a significant boost to their revenue. That's not small.
Yeah.
In terms of their numbers, obviously. For Google and Facebook, they're like, oh, psh, $30, $40 million a year.
Yeah.
But for these businesses, it's like, holy smokes, this is like, you know, 20, 30% of our total revenue.
You know what? I would love to see a breakdown of from their digital subscriptions. So, from people paying to view their paid articles on their news websites. I'd love to know how much of those people paid by directly going to, say, The Age, and how many found out about it through Google or Facebook, through finding an article on Google or Facebook. I'd love to know what percentage of their profitability is now basically driven by Google and Facebook.
Yeah. But it is what it is. I would like to know that too. That would be very interesting. However, I feel like it's not information we're going to be given. Because I think it would pull their pants down.
Yeah, I think it wouldn't quite be that good for the company. Yeah. But there you go. Yeah. $30 to $40 million. And that's just one.
Yeah, I feel like Nine Entertainment might reveal that it's actually a Google and Facebook proxy. It's like the only reason we exist is because of these companies.
Yeah.
Anyway, wowee. That is interesting, though. I mean, no wonder they flex their political influence, political muscles, if it literally means they could increase their revenue by, like, what was their total revenue, you say?
Their total profit was $117 million. So,
$117 million, and this is just pure profit,
right?
Yeah,
I mean, you could count it as basically profit. It's not costing them anything except for political donations. I mean, it's not costing them anything at all.
Oh, Hamish Hodder, you are a pot stirrer, my friend. That was a good one. Oh, dear. But yeah, so they're getting a substantial bump to their revenue.
Yes.
Is my point. All right, couple Q&A questions.
Yeah, let's do it. What have we got right, here? No
where should we start?
Start from the top.
I can read you this one.
Okay. Yeah.
It says, "Hi, Hamish. Have you seen the new Texas Roadhouse book? It's called Made from Scratch and it gets released this week."
Yeah, it's funny, actually. Yeah, I had seen that and I did order a copy and it actually came today. It actually came just about half an hour before we started recording this podcast. So, I'm looking forward to reading it. I, of course, haven't started reading it yet, but I think Kent Taylor is probably one of the most interesting managers of a public company, or I should say was, unfortunately. He passed away last year due to some COVID complications. He is a great CEO. He's one of those managers who are just so genuine on every single call or every single interview, just purely genuine, honest about the company, has no ulterior motive. So it's going to be really interesting. I think it'll give me a deeper insight into the company specifically, which is one of my investments, but also into what makes a good company and what makes a good management team as well. So I'm really excited to go through this.
Mm. Yeah, I might have to try and get a copy as well, because from what I've seen and from what I've discussed with you, it seems like he did a phenomenal job with Texas Roadhouse.
Yeah.
It seems like that business, I remember when we were looking at it, from a business perspective, I've never actually been to a Texas Roadhouse, but from a business perspective, that it looked like a boss business and still does. So, yeah, I'd be very interested to hear. I hope it really goes into the nitty gritty of you know, the business side of things.
Yeah, I hope so too.
But obviously, I've got no idea what it's going to be about, but hopefully it's good.
Yeah, yeah, exactly right.
All right, should we do one more?
Yeah, I'll read one to you. Do you want me to read this top one? I haven't gone through it yet. Which one?
Second one. All right. Do the second one.
I have a question for the next podcast. With all the recent regulation happening in China, I've heard that in the coming years, the number of Chinese companies listed in the US will significantly decline. If a large company like Alibaba or its ADR was delisted from the New York Stock Exchange, what would happen to investors' money? Would they have an opportunity to sell, or would they lose all of their money? Thanks heaps.
Yeah, so I thought we should do this one today because we were talking about it last week with Tom. This I did not know the answer to because I wasn't sure how it worked. For context, if you weren't listening last week, a lot of investors in the US, there is a US listed version of Alibaba, which is the ticker symbol Baba, which is actually you're buying into an entity in the Cayman Islands and that entity buys into shares of Alibaba. So there's a lot of, you know, rumor, speculation that there's going to be a crackdown and US listed Chinese stocks will get delisted. Mm. And in which case is what the question is getting to, what happens? You know, if you're an investor in a delisted company, what happens? And to be honest, I didn't actually know the answer. It's like, well, what does happen if it just a rule means that all of a sudden it gets delisted? So I found an article on CNBC, which pretty much just explained it. So I'll just read a quote from this article. It says here, once a stock is delisted, the company's shares can keep trading through a process known as over the counter, but that means the stock is outside the system of major financial institutions, deep liquidity, and the ability for sellers to find a buyer quickly without losing money. So it's outside of that main system. But they do draw an example here. It says, last summer, coffee and just for context, this article was from January of this year, so it is quite an old article now, but it says, last summer, Chinese coffee chain operator Luckin Coffee was delisted from the NASDAQ after the company revealed the fabrication of 2.2 million yuan or 340 million in sales. Yeah, the stock hit a 52-week low of 95 cents a share, but the shares rose even after going over the counter and closed at $8.64 each on Monday. So this is Monday of whenever the article was released. But I mean, it seemed the impression that I got from this article was it's not the end, but it does make share trading and you know institutional ownership much less common, and it might mean that the stock, that the impression that I got is that you don't want to be invested in a big company that gets delisted because you probably won't be able to sell for a price that you were looking to sell at.
Yeah.
That's the impression I got, but it doesn't mean, technically it doesn't mean that it's the end, you've lost your money.
No, you can definitely still trade your shares over the counter, but it's much more difficult. Volume is usually extremely low and it's difficult to find buyers and sellers. It's difficult to say what would happen, I think, with something like Alibaba, because it's such a big company with so many investors in the US. But yeah, it certainly would not be good, I think, for the stock. I think that's fairly easy to say, but that's an interesting example that they fabricated $340 million in sales. Yikes.
Yeah.
My goodness.
Yeah. I feel like that broke the NASDAQ's rules.
Wow. Yeah. Very good.
There you go. All right, team. That will just about do us for today. Thanks for those questions, guys. They were good. We do have one more question, which we'll get to next week. But yeah, apart from that, please, you know, feel free to send us in any questions you might want us to cover on the podcast. All you have to do is go to I get this wrong every time, The Young Investors Podcast, youtube.com/ The Young Investors Podcast. Yep. And just click on the most recent podcast episode, head down to the comments, leave us a comment, and then we just literally paste the questions into our Google Doc each week. Very high tech solution here at the Young Investors Podcast. But guys, that'll just about do us for today. Thank you very much for your time. Thanks for listening in. Thanks for tuning in every week. We really do appreciate it, and we hope you get something good out of the podcast. Hope it's slightly entertaining and mostly informative as well. Thanks, Hamish, for joining me as always. Thanks to ShareSite for sponsoring, and we'll see you guys next week.
See you guys.